Case number 20-1762. United States of America, ex rel. Elizabeth W. Kennedy et al. And Elizabeth W. Kennedy, appellant, versus Novo AS et al. Mr. Mendoza for the appellant Elizabeth W. Kennedy, Ms. Sean for the appellee United States of America.
You can begin, Mr. Mendoza. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Nicolas Mendoza, representing appellant Elizabeth Kennedy. The government has abandoned the district court's reasoning below. The district court's sole and categorical holding was that the alternate remedy provision does not apply when the government elects to intervene in the key TAM. The government does not defend this holding and even concedes that the intervention decision is not necessarily dispositive to the applicability of the alternate remedy provision. Congress wrote the alternate remedy provision with the broadest possible language, specifying that it applied notwithstanding the government's intervention decision under subsection B, and that it applies to any alternate remedy available and elected by the government. Congress did so in part so that the government would not be able to whittle away the relator share by reallocating funds away from the FCA action. But that is what the-
I'm sorry.
No.
Do you want to sum up? Go ahead, finish that sentence.
Just that is what the district courts has allowed in this case.
Right, sure. So the alternate remedy decision says, we all have to know alternate to what, right? And it says the government may elect to pursue its claim, singular claim, through any alternate remedy. And claim is defined in 3729 as 3729B2 as essentially a false claim, right? It's not everything claim the government could litigate against a defendant. It is only those claims that involve obtaining money, property through false or fraudulent pretenses. Is that right?
Well, there are seven enumerated offenses in the False Claims Act. Congress's purpose in incentivizing the prosecution of those claims included preserving the incentive for the whistleblower by allowing the government flexibility, but also guaranteeing the relator a share should the government choose a different proceeding.
A different proceeding for its claim.
For its claim first alerted to it by the relator's key TAM complaint.
Its claim is defined specifically by the statute as a False Claims Act claim.
Section 3730 repeatedly refers to the action. So if Congress intended to limit the government's claim to a sort of formal to the formal limits of the FCA action, it would have used the government may pursue the action in another proceeding.
Let me try this asking in the provision at issue here. 3730, is it E5? Sorry, losing track.
C5.
I apologize. Do you agree that the use, when it says may, the government may elect to pursue its claim through any alternate remedy, the claim there refers to the claim defined in the preceding section 3729?
The claim refers to the government's it refers to the government's claim within the valid key TAM action brought under 3729, but
I'm just asking again, the definition. Let me try asking a little bit more precisely. I wasn't clear enough. There's a definition of claim in 3729.
Yes.
B2. When they talk about in C5, 3730 C5, the alternate remedy provision, the government may elect to pursue its claim through an alternate remedy. Is your position that claim means what it was defined to mean in the preceding section, or do you think claim there has a different meaning?
I think the claim means given that the sentence says any alternate remedy, we think the
it doesn't say for any claim. I'm just asking you, do you think claim means what it's defined to mean in 3729, Or do you mean it, think claim means something different?
I think it means something different in that it refers to the government's the claims that the government could bring given the action within the context of subsection C. I think that's what makes the most sense. Otherwise, there would be more specificity from Congress that the claim has to be formally what was raised under 3729. I'm sorry, I'm Mr. going into
Mr.
my
Mendoza,
rebuttal.
Don't worry about that. We'll give you some extra time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If I could ask you about another phrase in C5, how do you understand the phrase, if an alternate remedy is pursued in another proceeding, the person initiating the action shall have the same rights in such proceeding as such person would have had if the action had continued under this section, right? To me, that phrase suggests that the action has not continued under this section. But of course, in this case, the action did continue and resulted in a very substantial remedy. So how do you understand that phrase would have had if the action had continued under this section?
Well, I have two quick points on that, Judge Rao, if you'll allow me. First, the most logical reading of that sentence is that the relator is given the same rights in the alternate remedy proceeding as if the FCA action had been litigated. And that's given the forcefulness of the notwithstanding instruction at the beginning of the provision, as well as the Supreme Court's direction in State Farm to not read out relator's rights without explicit language. But my the second point on that is that in this case,
so a settlement is not encompassed within that phrase? Is that?
Well, in this case, neither action continued. So I think that's a good example of what I mean here. The remedy was settled as soon as it was elected, so it did not continue. So in this case, even with the government's more restrictive reading, it literally is correct that the sentence operates to give relators rights as if the FCA action had been litigated, which in this case it did not. And
it
also
say litigated, it says continued.
Correct, Your Honor. And in this case, it did not continue. It settled as soon as it began. But I would also ask you to consider what would have happened if the government had litigated the FCA action in this case. It doesn't seem conceivable that they would have been able to sustain a parallel FTCA action, if nothing else, because Novo Nordisk would not have consented to it. And it certainly seems even less likely that they would have been able to file the FTCA action after the FCA action had been litigated to judgment. So in terms of fulfilling Congress's purpose of preserving the relator's incentive, our reading here is the most logical. That we shouldn't treat the FCA action as if it had been continued just because the defendant consented to that, to this unusual arrangement of two remedies for the same conduct.
I'm sorry, Judge Rao, are you done?
Go ahead.
If the government hadn't intervened, could Ms. Kennedy have added a claim for misbranded marketing of the drug under the FDCA?
No, Your Honor.
She couldn't, because that wouldn't be a qualifying claim under the False Claims Act.
That's correct. Her ketamp, the False Claims Act does not allow her to plead that. However, she couldn't have pleaded an administrative proceeding for a civil money penalty either, which is expressly encompassed within the provision.
Right.
Really,
on what claims she could bring.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're right. The administrative ones are prosecuted by the government, for sure. Under your theory that relators like Ms. Kennedy, who was obviously extremely helpful to the government here, can recover as long as the claim for recovery that's pursued through an alternate remedy arises from the same facts that were disclosed by the QTAM relator. What if the government had undertaken a criminal prosecution of the company in this case, or an individual in the company, relying on all those same facts and obtained a criminal fine? Are relators allowed a share of criminal fines?
Well, Your Honor, criminal proceedings raise interesting questions, perhaps for other statutory reasons, but
I'm just asking whether under your theory,
right,
it would meet arising out of this same factual situation.
What
in the text here says that it wouldn't fit within the alternate remedy here?
Well, it would fit within this provision that we're talking about. I'm saying that there may be other reasons why it might not be possible for a relator to seek a share.
Is your position that relators could or could not?
Our position is that within the FCA proceeding before Judge Walton, if there had been a criminal proceeding, the alternate remedy provision would have allowed a criminal remedy,
I understand it didn't happen here. I'm just asking, had there been, presumably not as part of the False Claims Act, but as a parallel action, a criminal prosecution, is it your position that it produced a fine, a substantial fine? Would Ms. Kennedy have been entitled to a QTAM relator's share of that fine arising out of the exact same facts?
Ms. Kennedy could have moved within the FCA proceeding before Judge Walton, certainly for a share of any alternate remedy, including certainly a criminal proceeding. That was certainly within the Congress could have predicted that in 1986. It was very common to go after fraud and in criminal actions. So certainly this is very broad language that Congress wrote. But
I first asked this question. You mentioned that you thought there are other parts of the False Claims Act that would carve out criminal actions, but it sounds like for purposes of this alternate remedy recovery, your position is that criminal recoveries would also be encompassed.
Well, not necessarily the False Claims Act. I mean, the district courts that have looked at this have differed a little bit, but generally the disputes have been over whether a relator has a right to intervene in a criminal action. Sure. But putting all that aside, that's not an issue in this case. For the purposes of the alternate remedy provision, certainly a criminal recovery would be within that language, because otherwise the government could proceed criminally against a QTAM defendant and render them judgment proof. And by the time the relator got to litigate her FCA action, the incentive to carry out that action and alert the government in the first place would have been destroyed by the criminal proceeding. So certainly I think Congress wanted that incentive preserved.
Do my colleagues have any more questions? All right, thank you very much. And we'll give you some time for rebuttal, Mr. Mendoza.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court, Karen Schoen on behalf of the United States. And let me just apologize. There is some construction work that just started, so I apologize if you hear it. The purpose of the alternate remedy provision is to protect relators when the government pursues another fraud remedy in place of the relator's False Claims Act suit. But here, the government settlement under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act didn't take the place of relator suit. And indeed, it couldn't have, because it wasn't even a fraud remedy. The government intervened in relator's False Claims Act suit and settled it with relator's consent, and relator received a $7.8 million share of the proceeds. And the district court correctly recognized that in these circumstances, the alternate remedy provision simply doesn't apply.
When you say a fraud claim, is that a shorthand for the definition of claim in 3729?
Yes, Your Honor. I meant a shorthand for, you know, a claim alleging false claims to the government under Section 3729. So the sort of claim that a relator could bring, or that the government could bring on its own behalf under the False Claims Act.
If the government here, instead of pursuing that administrative remedy, had added an FDCA claim for equitable disgorgement or just any form of penalty to the existing QTAM action. So it intervenes and it adds claims as it's allowed to do, other claims as it's allowed to do. And let's say through settlement or litigation, there's a recovery that's collectively for all the claims pressed by the government and the false claim pressed by the relator. Would the relator be able to recover a share if there's just one judgment? What would happen? Would they recover a share of the total judgment, even though it included both False Claims Act claims and an FDCA claim?
No, Your Honor. The relator would only be entitled to a share of the proceeds with respect to relators, the claims that relator brought under the False Claims Act. I mean, a relator can only recover to the extent that she has a valid claim under the False Claims Act, and to the extent the government also asserted other non-False Claims Act claims. The wrong way to phrase that, you know, the relator isn't entitled to a share of those.
What's your best case for that and for how it gets sorted out if there's just a lump sum damage award or settlement at the end?
I mean, I think the courts have, you know, have held, and I think it's well established that a relator has to have a valid claim to be entitled to recovery, whether it's through
she had a valid claim. There's no question
right.
about that.
But I think the corollary to that is to the extent there is recovery for a claim that could not be brought under the False Claims Act, right? If a relator had brought the FDCA claim or some other claim, I mean, she couldn't, right? That would have been dismissed. She couldn't bring that. And so the fact that the
I'm asking when the government brings them all in, then are there
but I think it's the
said we hook or by crook, we are going to have to divvy up the final. I just couldn't find any cases that address this situation.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any cases. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm not aware of any cases addressing that specific fact pattern, but I think the reasoning is the same. Whether the government brought it in a separate action or brought it in the same action, the relator is only entitled to recover for her claims. And so, you know, the fact that the government brought it all in one proceeding, I don't think changes the analysis or the end result. I think it's the same. Relator is entitled to recovery to the extent that there were proceeds from the claim that she brought. She's not entitled to recover for other claims.
Doesn't the government invariably in these kinds of cases bring the False Claims Act piece and the FDCA piece together in one case?
I don't know how it works in practice. I think there are often parallel proceedings, you know, and putting aside the FDCA, there may be other proceedings, you know, whether they're criminal proceedings, there may be proceedings under the tax code, there may be a lot of other proceedings that may go in parallel. I'm not sure that the government always brings, as a practical matter, always brings them in the same action.
I thought as a practical matter, they were brought together and there would be obvious claim preclusion problems if they weren't brought together. They're arising out of the same facts, right?
I apologize, Your Honor. I just don't know how it works.
I mean, the reason
normal course.
The reason I ask, assume that's the case. The reason I ask is your position makes a lot of intuitive sense. But what do we do with 37D1, which defines the relator's share as 15% to 25% of the proceeds of the action or settlement of the claim? But action to me reads more broadly than fraud claim. Action reads like it is the case in which the FCA cause of action and the FDCA cause of action are litigated.
I think it goes back to the same point, which is that a relator isn't entitled to a share of claims that she didn't even bring. I mean, the point is to encourage and provide an incentive for relators to bring these sorts of claims, but they're not entitled to recovery for claims that they didn't bring themselves. And I think, you know, I think Congress obviously knew that there may be other proceedings and the government may have other actions to pursue, but those aren't all fraud claims. And here the FDCA action is not, I'll use the shorthand again, it's not a fraud remedy. It has nothing to do with allegations that there were false claims submitted to the government. That's a wholly different sort of action and sort of violation of the statute. It has nothing to do with fraud against the public fist.
One question I have is, for the government to prevail here, we don't need to reach, we can decide, I guess, either that the FTC action is not an alternative remedy, or we could decide that the government's pursuit of the FCA claim renders the alternate remedy provision inapplicable, right? We could decide on either one of those grounds for the government to prevail. Which, in your view, is a narrower reading? I mean, there are not very many cases interpreting the FCA, and I'm concerned about unintended consequences of a broad ruling of this admittedly somewhat obscure provision.
I'm not quite sure. I think probably the narrower ruling would just be that the I'm not sure that there is really a key distinction between the two, in the sense that an alternate remedy is one that takes the place of a relator's claim. So it's one, as courts have recognized, that the government pursues in lieu of pursuing the False Claims Act suit. And so to the extent that the government actually pursued the False Claims Act suit and settled it, the alternate remedy provision doesn't apply. And so I think that's probably one of your sort of readings. The other would be to say that the FDCA action is not an alternate remedy, but the reason it's not an alternate remedy is because it doesn't take the place of the False Claims Act suit. It's not a fraud remedy. It's not dealing with allegations of fraud against the government or the submission of false claims to the government. It's a very different violation of the law. And so it doesn't sort of, as a matter of law, take the place of a False Claims Act suit. So I think that the two kind of go hand in hand, and I'm not quite sure how to fully answer your question in terms of which is the narrower, because I think they are, in a sense, sort of two sides of the same coin.
Well, let me ask you some questions then about what it would mean for the government to pursue the FCA claim. So if the government intervenes, but then they proceed with the action, but they proceed to dismiss the action, in that situation, would the FDCA claim be an alternate remedy? Because they've in some sense continued with it. They've entered, they've prosecuted, but they've exercised their prosecutorial discretion to dismiss the case, right? Is that what happens to the FDCA claim in that?
Yeah, I think in this case, if the government had dismissed the False Claims Act suit, that still would not make the FDCA action an alternate remedy. And the reason is because it's not a remedy for a claim under the False Claims Act. It's not a remedy for allegations of submission of false claims to the government. It's a wholly different violation of the statute. So it's not a remedy for a claim within the meaning of the False Claims Act. And so it wouldn't be. Now, I mean, I think, stepping back from this case, there might be circumstances where the government's dismissal could result in an alternate remedy if what the government pursued, an administrative fraud proceeding or some other civil fraud proceeding that actually did address the claim, that would be a different story. But I think here the key point is that the action under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is not, and I'll use the shorthand again, is not a fraud remedy. It's not a remedy for the claim under the False Claims Act.
I hear you did settlements. And so imagine the settlement in the False Claims Act suit was for $1,000. And then the simultaneous FDCA action was for $8 million or $10 million or $30 million. And so the government uses this non-FCA claim. The defendant doesn't care. They're going to pay the same amount one way or the other. If you want to stick it under in box A or box B, they don't care. But the government cares because it gets 100% versus 75 or 80% recovery. And so what's to stop the government, under your theory, from doing very small settlements or much smaller settlements of the FCA claim and then using some non-FCA type claim settlement to put all the real recovery there and to keep the QTAM, cut the QTAM relator out?
Well, I think what stops the government in part is another provision under Section 3730C2 capital B, which gives the relator the right to object to a settlement. And a settlement can proceed over the relator's objection only to the extent that the court determines after hearing that it is fair, adequate, and reasonable. And so I think to the extent there's a concern that the,
well, the
that
government the settlement- go into that and say, look, these are really high standards of proof. We don't think we are going to be able to prevail on a standard of fraud here. And let's make it, you know, not quite so transparent what's going on. And let's say that one's for $1 million. But the government says, you know, it's good. We're really worried about meeting the standard of proof of fraud, which is really hard here, sort of mens rea, the knowingly here, knowingly as to the falsity. So that's why we're settling that. And then we're going to go over here at the same time, or a week later, the settling defendant's not going to raise res judicata and says, here's our FDCA settlement, and that's where the huge amount of money is. And the QTAM relator doesn't know the FDCA settlement's coming. I know it was mentioned here in the settlement agreement, but assume it's not mentioned. Doesn't know it's coming. So there's nothing to object to, or any objection is rejected by the district court. You understand the government's incentives here to split up its claims to the extent it's allowed to through the settlement process.
Again, though, I think it really is a fairness issue. It doesn't turn something that's not otherwise an alternate remedy into an alternate remedy. And I think, you know, there isn't perfect information at settlement, right? There are a lot of variables and a lot of things to weigh. And, you know, I think to the extent the government has a valid concern about the ability to actually prevail through litigation and obtain a judgment and so that's what makes settlement worthwhile. I mean, I think that's the same sort of analysis and calculus that the relator has to go through and that the court would have to assess and see whether the government was sort of raising a valid concern and whether the settlement, taking into account all those sorts of variables and all the uncertainty, is fair, adequate, and reasonable. But I think that really is something.
Does the government have an obligation to tell the relator and the district court judge about any other remedies it intends to pursue for these same facts before a settlement's approved?
I want to be careful here because I think there may be some times when what the government can disclose, the government may not always be able to share everything depending on what the other proceeding is. And, you know, for example, in the context of a criminal proceeding, there may be
okay,
some
let's say for any
confidentiality.
Other
but so I want to be careful.
Civil proceeding, because that's what I think is assumed here. Any other civil proceeding by the government?
Again, I do want to be careful because there may be some confidentiality.
Well, you can tell so, file it under seal with the district court. Where there's
more dealing
with confidentiality.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly if the relator raised an objection and questioned the fairness
No, the relator doesn't know anything. Doesn't raise an objection other than, golly gee, I think we could prove the case, but doesn't object. That doesn't know about another proceeding. Do you think the government has an obligation so that the district court can assess the fairness of a settlement or dismissal decision to tell at least the district court, if not the relator, if there's some confidentiality reason, about other civil remedies being pursued arising from these same facts?
I think the court isn't going to assess the reasonableness of the settlement unless the relator objects. So I think just sort of as a sort of an affirmative obligation, I don't think there's any obligation to
I said there was an objection, but the objection isn't based on the settlement. The objection is based on, I think, don't dismiss it. I think we can prove our case.
I mean, I guess I'm sorry, I misunderstood your hypothetical. I apologize. I mean, I think to the extent that the court is then conducting some sort of hearing and looking at the question whether it is fair, adequate, and reasonable, then I think it is for the court to, you know, sort of ask what information it wants from the government. And to the extent that the court wants to know whether there are other actions, then yes, the government probably has a duty to disclose that. But I don't want
to
suggest
that. Only if the court asks, to be clear, that your position is only if the court asks.
I may be sort of in over my head a little bit in terms of I can't promise what the government has to do without knowing all the circumstances of a particular case. I mean, I think to the extent we are in a situation where the relator has objected and the district court is looking for information about the case, then I think it certainly would be reasonable for the government to share the relevant facts and circumstances with the court.
Michonne, on your view, though, the FDCA action is not an alternate remedy at all and can never be an alternate remedy. Isn't that the government's position?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. So then on Judge Millett's question, I mean, I think under your view, you wouldn't have to disclose that to the district court because it wouldn't be relevant to the FCA remedy at all.
That's right. I mean, the only question for the court to be considering is whether the settlement under the False Claims Act is fair, adequate, and reasonable, and whether the recovery, the settlement proceeds are reasonable with respect to the claims under the False Claims Act.
So can you just also tell me a little bit why, how do we know what an alternate remedy is, right? So you say very definitively FDCA is not, even though arguably some of those FDCA claims at least sound in something that sounds like fraud to the government. They're not FCA claims. I mean, what exactly is an alternate remedy or what would be included in that category on the government's view?
I think it's one that is meant to take the place of a False Claims Act proceeding. So it's one that addresses allegations of, you know, false claims submitted to the government. So it's sort of fraud against the public fisc. And so, you know, I think that the quintessential example in the statute in C5 itself is an administrative fraud proceeding where it's the same, you know, it's basically the same sort of claim. It's just adjudicated in a different proceeding. And I think that's sort of the gist of what an alternate remedy is. It's a remedy for the same claim, but just in a different forum than a False Claims Act suit, or it could potentially be another False Claims Act suit. But I think the point is that it's still meant to address the same sort of allegations and the same sort of claim that you bring under the False Claims Act.
What if it wasn't obtaining their FDCA approval to market this drug? You made commitments to make disclosures and warnings to doctors and maybe warning labels or information with the drug. You made commitments. And the assertion is those were false commitments. You were never planning to keep them because you don't believe these disclosures really should have to take place. And so that's what the administrative proceeding was. You wrongfully obtained authorization to market this drug or marketed it improperly because you didn't include the appropriate disclosures and you never intended to.
I think again, it's not that doesn't have anything to do though with fraud against the government in the sense of fraud against the public fisc.
No, but it doesn't have to be the fisc. You're obtaining property as well. You're obtaining a license. You're obtaining a permission and authorization from the government through false pretenses. You say that isn't included? It doesn't meet anything in the definition.
I don't know if there would be some theory of liability under the False Claims Act, but that's not the suit we have here.
A request from the government is included.
To obtain
money or property.
Your Honor, I don't want to speculate in terms of whether there would be some theory of liability under the False Claims Act. I think the key point here, though, is that's not the situation we have here.
We just don't get to write opinions that way. And so what assurance do we have against the government especially in this double settlement situation where Judge Katz's wise point about res judicata isn't going to be implemented. What protection does a QI-TAM relator have if we adopt your definition, adopt the rule you want, in a case where the government puts most of the weight on the so-called non-FCA claim and most of the recovery there, but not so much that it's obvious what's going on, and maybe doesn't say a word when the FCA settlement is going through? What protection?
I think that the key protection is C2B.
That can't happen if nobody knows what's going on and you weren't willing to say that there was any obligation of the government to be upfront with what it's doing, even apart from a confidentiality concern. So I don't see how that's any protection at all if nobody else knows.
But I think the fairness of the, whether the settlement under the False Claims Act is fair, adequate, and reasonable, I think is sort of an independent question. The fact that the government may have an action for other claims that are not false claims, not the sort of claim that you would bring under the False Claims Act, the fact that the government may have that other action is really, in some sense, beside the point. I understand your concern about the shifting proceeds, but I think if that's the concern, then it's really just that what you're saying is that the settlement under the False Claims Act was not fair, adequate, and reasonable, that taking into account all the various, you know, things to consider and the risks of litigation, that still is not fair, adequate, and reasonable. And that's what C2B is meant to address. And I think that's what relator can raise her hand and say, I don't think this is fair, adequate, and reasonable. I think the government could really prove has a stronger claim and could really prove more and get a better deal at litigation than we're getting here. And I think relator can do that whether the government is pursuing or may pursue a separate action for a wholly different violation of the law.
My colleagues have further questions? All right, thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Mendoza, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to quickly discuss the relatedness of the FDCA action. This is the exact same facts first alerted by my client in 2010. It alleges a form of fraud and practice, which is introducing misbranded drugs. There's no additional actual difference between the actions of the defendant in both proceedings. And the government settled both of them simultaneously with Novo Nordisk's consent, but then waited until after the FCA action had been resolved to file the FDCA action in the same court before the same judge with the same Department of Justice attorneys. So I disagree with my friend from the government that this is not in any way a form of fraud. This is. The Congress did not impose any sort of formal fraud requirement on the alternate remedy. That's why it said any alternate remedy, notwithstanding the government's decision to intervene. And Judge Katsas, you're completely correct that this is a very unusual thing for the government to have done the separate actions. And as Judge Millett, you were discussing there's no right for the relator to know, to participate in settlement negotiations or to get information from the government. What's afforded the relator is a relator share right and the right to object. Right to object, I'd also like to point out that the district court has made no findings as to whether relator agreed to waive their her alternate remedy rights and there was no, there was nothing other than a reference to an FDCA action in the FCA settlement to the drug Victoza. It could have been for any conduct. It's certainly not a very strange thing for the government to do. Well,
Did your client inquire? I mean, your client actually was given notice of another settlement. Did your client seeing that in the settlement agreement go, hey, wait, I need to know more about what that is, what the claim is there that's being settled before I can tell whether this is fair?
Your Honor, the counsel for relator was told that, I mean, again, the district court didn't address this, but Counsel for Relator was told that this was all the government could get from defendant Novo Nordisk. When
I know, but you were told there was another action or settlement out there. My question to you is simply, did you inquire further about the relatedness or not of that proceeding to the factual allegations at issue here?
I believe counsel for Relator did inquire, and there was a back and forth. This is discussed in the Fraser Declaration.
Did they tell the alert the district court to any concerns, or they had no concerns based on this back and forth?
As far as I know, there was no communication about this with the district court. And in fact, the district court wasn't aware of the FTC action at all until it was filed in the district court on September 5th, 4 days after the FCA action was dismissed.
So Ms. Kennedy's counsels didn't raise any concerns about this or questions or need for information about this with the district court?
Well, Your Honor, I can't speak. I wasn't there, but my understanding is this is discussed in the Fraser Declaration. I believe there was a back and forth over
what was raised with anything was raised with the district court. And you said the district court didn't.
No, Your Honor. A relator was not in a position to raise it with the district court. Okay. And the government has many remedies and many, many possible actions against pharmaceutical companies. And this could have been for any for unrelated conduct, and it given the unusual structure of the settlements, that's what would have made sense. So, thank you.
My colleagues have any questions? No. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case is submitted.